Boston, Massachusetts, around 12:30 a.m., March 18, 1990. On the east side of Palace Road, just beyond the harsh glare of a sodium streetlight, two men sit in a small gray hatchback. The man in the driver's seat is stocky and broad-shouldered with round cheeks and squinty James Dean eyes. The other man is shorter, standing just under 5'10". Both men are dressed as police officers, and they look the part. Dark blue uniforms, eight-point service caps, and the nylon knee-length coats that beat cops use to stay dry on wet New England nights. A light rain fell earlier in the day. Water beads on the window of the hatchback. Across the street, a few late-night revelers spill out of an apartment building. Very young, seniors in high school, and just left a college dorm party because the beer ran out. "They have to go somewhere," one of the revelers said. "Should they try and sneak into a bar on Huntington Avenue, or pick up a case of beer and head to someone's house?" Jerry Stratberg jokes with one of his friends, pulling her onto his back and wobbling her piggyback style south along Palace Road. He seesaws down the sidewalk for a few yards. She taps him on the shoulder. "Watch out. There's a cop in that car over there," she says. Stratberg sees the broad-shouldered man in the driver's seat and steps toward him. Through the thin fog, they stare at each other, the broad-shouldered man giving Stratberg a flinty look that says, "Back off. Go home." Stratberg notices the man's unusual eyes. "What are the cops doing here? Looking for thieves? Drug dealers?" Still, Stratberg thinks nothing good can come from this. He's under the legal drinking age, a few months away from his high school diploma. "Let's go back and tell the others," he says. His friend slips from his shoulders. The two soberly cross the street. They whisper quietly with their group before they all hop in a car and roar off. The street falls silent. Some oak trees quiver in the wind. Then shortly after 1 a.m., the two men step onto the sidewalk, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum looming above them like a castle. The 19th-century heiress Isabella Stewart Gardner designed the four-story building as a replica of Renaissance-era Venetian palazzo, with soaring balconies, stone stibulets, and a blooming courtyard brimming with lofty palms and hothouse jasmines. Art was Gardner's passion, and she built a world-class possession. Well, that's from the opening of The Gardner Heist, the true story of the world's largest unsolved art theft. It's a story, as I hope you'll note, that grabs us readers from its opening pages. The grand collection of that art aficionado is ripped apart by thieves who steal into the museum on that rainy St. Patrick's night in 1990. Doing so, it seems, without rhyme or reason, given what they stole and what so very much they left behind. The theft known today by the museum's name, the Gardner Heist, leaves gaping holes in a collection developed over a lifetime by a passionate art lover who collected from Europe, from America, starting at the beginning of the Gilded Age in the late 19th century and continuing into the 20th. The well-heeled Isabella Gardner had intended her eclectic and thoughtfully gathered collection to be kept for art lovers to view in perpetuity, as she had it finally displayed, lest the entire museum collection be sold and its funds donated to Harvard. The woman who amassed this marvelous collection evidently never guessed that her life's work of beauty would be so grievously disturbed by thieves. As our story opens, our author, freelance journalist Ulrich Boser, has assigned himself the task of interviewing and writing an article about the man who had made solving this greatest art theft of its day his life's work. But little did he know, he too would be sucked into this story and become its latest exponent and investigator. It's fascinating how the author himself gets sucked into the heist story and how it becomes an addiction for him as much as for his predecessor, Harold Smith. The artworks the still unknown thieves took included many masterworks, including a Vermeer, three Rembrandts, five Degas sketches. The haul had an estimated worth of $500 million in its day. And much to everyone's surprise, including mine, none of the works has been recovered in the 27 years since those thefts took place. The characters we meet in this true-life detective story run the gamut of a novelist's sweetest dreams. Foremost is our author, who takes on the Gardner heist as the central work of his life, just as the first character we meet, Harold Smith, an insurance adjuster turned art theft investigator, died without having solved the greatest investigation of his life, and after persevering, by the way, with the support of his family through decades of cancer. Most notable of all, of course, of all the characters we meet is the art collector and museum founder Isabella Gardner, who is another reviewer when writing about this book and Isabella's life's work. Quote, "The premise is intriguing. Isabella Stewart Gardner lost her only son to pneumonia. Unable to have more children, she sinks into a deep depression. Only the healing power of art pulls her out of it. She begins collecting with the active participation of her husband and certain friends. Upon the death of her father and her beloved husband, she uses her inheritance money to build a house, modeled, as we heard, upon a grand Venetian grand home that Gardner had visited in Italy to hold her collection," end quote. And then there are the many, many suspects we meet. Our author takes the time to parade before us the stories he's tracked down of the not-so-few Boston underworld mobsters, politicians, lawyers, known thieves, con men, and a few art aficionados, all of whom are suspected of taking part in the mysterious theft, but none of whom are fingered by the conclusion of our book as the perpetrators or even the masterminds behind the crime. Not a few, though, are set up by the author as likely suspects. The story, and it's a true story, as I noted, prompts any number of questions. Why were those particular art pieces stolen? The Vermeer painting is perhaps a no-brainer. Because of the rarity of Vermeer paintings, it would be worth a king's ransom no matter which painting it happened to be. But what of the other more common artists' works? They took a flag finial, for heaven's sake, and they took sculptures. Why was there so little security at the museum? And have we the funding to expand security at any museum with significant artwork? As another reviewer wrote about this crime against art, quote, "I still can't get past the thieves cutting the paintings from their frames. Dang it, if you're going to heist something beautiful, at least treat it with respect. I'd always assumed art was well protected and that when it was stolen for or by someone who craved and treasured it." Bozer, our author, says this is not true. Until recently, museums did not have the funds or maybe even inclination to guard their works with state-of-the-art security measures, end quote. Why do we still revere iconoclasts like Gardner today? Why set up a museum as a visual, never-changing work of art, which is evidently what Isabella Gardner had in mind when she established her museum? And finally, perhaps the most important question, why is art so important that Isabella Gardner, Harold Smith, our author, would devote their lives to that siren song? Let me note that I had a quite enjoyable time discussing this book with members of the Museum of Greater Lafayette's Art League at their annual Books and Coffee discussion earlier in February, and I think you'll enjoy reading and hopefully discussing this page-turner of a true crime book as well. As a public librarian, I've learned over the years that true crime is one of the most popular parts of any public library collection. Evidently, we just cannot get enough reading about true crimes, whether they're solved or, in this case, unsolved. Let's finish, actually as our author does, with a few words about the Gardner Museum today, as he writes. "I returned to the Gardner Museum on a recent October morning, and the first thing to greet me was the smell, deep and earthy, a raw mixture of well-polished antiques and blooming orchids. It's like nothing I've ever smelled before or since, and I lingered in the cool darkness for a long moment before moving down a tight corridor and into the courtyard. A fireworks flash of color and light, the verdant garden radiating with lush tulips and sweeping palms, The Roman fountain bubbled quietly under the double staircase. Sparkling sunshine danced along the walls. In the middle of the greenery, a large Ptolemaic urn was tucked under a lily, as if Dionysus had left the vase behind the night before. It was hard to imagine a more beautiful crime scene. A tour guide led a group of students up the main staircase and toward the Dutch room, and as the sounds faded, a man sat himself Buddha-style along the ledge of the courtyard, meditating next to the Roman sarcophagus. Walking along the arched hallway, a visitor whispered reverently to his partner, tugging his arm, begging for the opportunity to show off his favorite painting. It would be my last visit for a while, and I studied the airy watercolors in the yellow room, the Matisse's, the Degas, the Whistler's. I drilled through the Chinese loggia and noted that on the first floor, Gardner built an entire room around John Singer Sargent's masterpiece, Aliajo, a massive oil painting of a flamenco dancer. To highlight the visual motif, she framed the work with a Moorish-style arch, a set of floor lights, and hundreds of blue and white Mexican tiles. The design gives the painting a vibrant cinematic vitality. And I stood in front of the canvas and felt as if I could hear the flamenco dancer click, click, clicking her heels on the floor, while the band stomped and hollered their way through a fiery love song. When Sargent first saw his painting within the setting, he told Gardner that she had done more for the artwork than he ever had. Eventually, I moved up the stairs and into the Dutch room. Nothing had changed. Everything stood the same. The empty frames, the roped-off Victorian chairs, the slash of brown velvet encased by a gilded setting. "Do you think the paintings will come back?" a woman asked the guard. He nodded. "Oh, yes. For sure they'll come back. Hope will never die here," he said. "And when they do return, I tell you we will have a line from here to downtown. Everybody will want to come and see these paintings." It's quite a story. It's quite a true story about an art theft, an art heist that continues to be unsolved to this day. The Gardner Heist, the true story of the world's largest unsolved art theft by Ulrich Boser, is available at all of our fine local libraries. Who wouldn't want this one in their collection? And, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library.